Today we do a bit of exploring on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. Rob Irwin's popular book on national parks has an interesting title, Lost with Directions. But we'll look for him now on Scribble. Sounds masculine to me.
Men never ask for directions.
That's true.
No. Especially nowadays with GPS, right? Yeah. You just type it in.
So were you deliberately trying to get lost, Rob?
I would not say so. I'd say I set out on this journey through the national parks with a bit of a roadmap, a bit of an idea of where I wanted to go and the things I wanted to see. But I end up getting lost, perhaps metaphorically in some ways, by trying to be a rugged outdoorsman, which I'm not at all, and it shows through pretty clearly through the book.
So how did what gave you the idea for the book?
Well, so I guess I'll give you the quick long story version.
Right.
I graduated from Augustana College here in 2008. Was a math major, but I was more interested in my role as a student assistant football coach here at the school. Graduated from Augie and got into the college coaching profession. Did that for years at a handful of different places, Montana State University, Northern Michigan, South Dakota Mines, you name it. I was all over the country. But when I fell in love, I decided to come back here to the Quad Cities and get married to my now wife, Kelly, which it's actually our 3-year anniversary tomorrow. So I got to make sure I say that so she so she knows that I know. But when I came back here, there wasn't anything coaching-wise for me at the time, so I took another kind of, I guess, standard 9-to-5 office job, and it really wasn't geared towards me. I quit a few months into it, and I said, I need something to do until I get back into coaching, and that's where the idea for going on an adventure and writing a travel book came to mind, and so that's how I filled that void.
So you began with the idea of writing a book.
I did. I had long been a fan of the travel adventure genre. I mean, you guys are probably very familiar with Bill Bryson, for
right.
instance, one of my favorite authors there. Really loved his style. I loved learning about the places. I loved laughing and learning with him. It was kind of the perfect combination. A handful of other great books got me interested in the genre, and so I wanted to give it my shot. I'd always thought of myself as a somewhat decent writer, and I'd read enough really good works on travel writing where I thought I know what it sounds like, I know what it reads like, I might be able to replicate it myself.
Well, so are you a positive travel writer? Or a lot of travel writers today, it seems to me, are quite negative. Another place to cross off your list, right?
Yeah, no, I very much tried to celebrate the places that I went to. Now, any of the laughter or laughing at anybody's expense comes at laughing at my expense because of the different errors and just goofy things that I do or encounter along the way. But I try to celebrate the places I visit. I really try to build them up in a positive way because more than anything, I'd love to get other people to, if they take a chance on my book, maybe they experience that same kind of thrill and exhilaration that I experienced reading Bill Bryson or other authors, for instance, and maybe get them to go on their own journey, push outside their comfort zone.
Your title is Lost with Directions. When did that title occur to you?
Oh, God, after about 100 bad ones. I've been very fortunate that I got a lot of positive feedback on the title. I at first had some really cruddy ones, and honestly, I didn't really solidify the title until probably about a month before it went out to press. And I don't know how it came to me. I think I was in the car with my wife, and she was driving somewhere, and it just kind of occurred to me. I threw it at her. She's like, "Yes, throw away the other one. Let's go with this." So it worked out well. It's catchy enough where it gets somebody to click on it or open a page and see what it's about.
You know, it's amazing how often that happens to a lot of writers. I mean, the title that they originally suggested or submitted is just terrible, right? And I forget what A Wrinkle in Time was first called, you know, but Madeleine L'Engle's book. But nobody would have picked it up to read it.
Yeah, it's incredible. You can put down 20,000 great words in you know a book format, but you can't pick out 5 good words to put on the front of that
right.
book. So
yeah.
I got fortunate that it stumbled upon.
So what does the title mean?
So I guess as I describe it to people, you know, the usual phrase is lost without directions.
Right.
I don't want to paint the portrait that I was just wandering off in the wilderness, you know, without a compass and just going. I had a pretty good idea of the places I wanted to go, the places I wanted to see, but it was getting there, trying to be this rugged outdoorsman, like I said, putting myself in these unusual, uncomfortable situations where I truly got lost. So that's kind of where the lost with directions came into play.
Where did you start?
So I started in the Smoky Mountains of Tennessee, right on the border of North Carolina.
My home state. Wonderful.
Which one, Tennessee or North Carolina?
Tennessee.
Oh, where at?
Way the other side, Memphis.
Oh, okay. Yeah, they're about as far the other side as you can
but
get.
But I did get to the Smokies finally, and the thing that stunned me driving up in the Smokies is what looked like jets of steam coming out of the rocks.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's just amazing.
Yeah, I had a really great experience. I knew next to nothing about the Smokies before I went. A little background. You know, I was a bit of a national parks guy before. I had worked a summer in Yellowstone National Park back in the summer of 2013 during the football off season. And so that's kind of where I fell in love with national parks and the wilderness, which I didn't have much of a background before. So I went out to the Smokies. That was completely different. I'd been to the West, but not the East. And one of the main things that I tried to accomplish out there was getting away from the crowds. The Smoky Mountains is by far the most highly visited national park in the U.S. About 10 million visitors to the park a year and another 6 to 7 million in the gateway community. So sometimes it can be like traffic on the I-74 bridge in and around that park. Uh-huh. So I wanted to try to find a secluded place and you know, as I talked about in the book, I was able to do that and really have a really genuine experience out there.
Mm-hmm. So you were not lost there.
Not so much lost. I went to the far, far eastern portion of the park, right on the North Carolina state line, and that's probably the least visited part of the park. I went on Memorial Day weekend. That was where I started my journey, and you know, I just said most crowded national park in the country, Memorial Day weekend. I mean, that's like the worst time to go. But where I was able to go, out by the Big Creek area, out by Mount Sterling, which, to give you an idea of kind of the terrain out there, it's so difficult to navigate. It used to be a hideout for deserters of the Civil War, both the Union and the Confederates. So it's pretty winding, remote, hilly backcountry. It's hard to travel around, which is why people don't go. They can't drive their big RVs, conveniently up to the different landmarks. So I was able to get up to a fire tower, old fire tower atop of Mount Sterling. And the entire way I saw two other vehicles the entire time I was there on the busiest weekend in the busiest national park in the country.
Yeah, you did find a remote spot.
Yes, and it was pretty incredible. It really lent itself towards the reason why I think you go to those places in the first place, is not to experience the kind of amusement park crowdedness and the concession stands and all that sadly a lot of people's experiences in the national parks is that it was able to get that more genuine wilderness experience, which I was looking for.
Yeah, I worked at for 3 summers in college. I worked at Glacier National Park.
Ooh.
And I got so sick of the tourists who sat in the lobby drinking gin and tonic to say, "What's there to do around here?" Right? And they saw the 5 obligatory sites, right, going to the Sun Highway and
yep.
And so forth. We employees were. Uh-huh. All over the place, up to Iceberg Lake and hiking up to Canada and really getting lost with directions, too. So I know the feeling.
Yeah.
So it is easy, even in a crowded Memorial Day weekend, to really get away from the crowd because the crowd does the same old things.
You're
over
exactly
and over.
Right. Yeah. As you're probably familiar, as the old saying goes, 99% of the people see just 1% of the park, and that's
right.
Where there's a convenient parking lot, and that's, like you said, the obligatory landmarks. But if you get off the beaten path, even just a quarter mile, just take a trail and go for a short walk, you can see the 99% of the park that the rest of the people don't see.
Now, did you ever really get lost?
Yeah, actually, a little bit. Towards the very end. So the last experience I talk about is in Colorado's Rocky Mountain National Park. And this was, it was mid to early June, if I'm recalling correctly, and so, which out there means it's still basically in the middle of spring.
Right.
There's still a lot of snow up at the elevation.
On the trails, right.
So we started down by the Grand Lake entrance, which most people go in through Estes Park, but we started down South Grand Lake, and a couple friends and I were in the Tanahutu Valley, and we'd heard about this lake, high elevation alpine lake up there that we were just told we had to go to. You know, your experience won't be complete without it, especially if you know you're trying to get off the beaten path. So we started ascending, and eventually we reached the snow line, and we made the very, very amateur mistake of continuing without the trail directly visible. So it started off as about an inch of snow, got ankle deep, then knee high deep, and then suddenly we're trudging through like like mule waist high deep through this snow until we get to a clearing where the sun had actually frozen all of it. So we weren't trudging through it anymore. We could actually walk on it. We saw what looked like a trail marker about a quarter mile up ahead. We're like, okay, we found it. So we start walking, but then we start experience what's called post-holing, which is where that frozen snow on top is still not frozen underneath, is actually very soft. It's the constant freezing and de-thawing during the spring. And so at one point, at the very end point, I fell through the snow about up to my armpits, and I could see down, and there was a chasm in the snow below me about 8 to 9 feet deep. And the crazy thing is, if I would have fallen in there, I might still be up there on that mountain and not in a good way. So that was the one time we really got lost. Yeah. And that was the last real experience like that on the trip. After that, it was time to go home. So,
how many parks did you visit?
So I started off in the Smoky Mountains in the east, backtracked back to my old stomping grounds, Yellowstone in the west. Of course, when you're in Yellowstone, you want to go directly south. And there's Grand Teton National Park as well. So I spent some time there and then finished up in Rocky Mountain National Park. So there's only four national parks, but a lot of the fun and a lot of the interesting things along the way happened in the small towns in between that often don't get a lot of the attention. So I think of places like, you know, Thermopolis, Wyoming, for instance, you know, just kind of a place in the middle of nowhere that you might only just pass by if you're going between these various parks. But that's where I found a lot of the fun to take place as well.
Mm-hmm. You know, two things. If you go to Glacier National Park now, you're not going to see much in the way of glaciers.
No,
they are disappearing.
Very true.
The second, you touched on something that has been a hot topic in the whole business of national parks, public use and true conservation, where you leave the land alone.
Mm-hmm.
That people want to go and see, and they want a paved road to get there, an easy path to climb, a rest stop, sanitary facilities along the way. That's not real nature.
Agreed.
It is an approximation.
Yeah.
So where do you fall in that argument?
You know, I'm a bit like, you know, a bit like Roald. It sounds like, I think especially when you're not just a visitor, but when you actually perhaps have spent time as maybe a seasonal employee, for instance, and you see the day-to-day kind of business or operation of the places, I think you do see that. I think there is a very serious issue of overcrowdedness, over-visitation, over-development. You know, I think recently it was that the National Parks proposed, you know, pretty significantly raising the entrance fees to the parks in an attempt to try to curb visitation, you know, attempt to curb the impact that all the tourists were having on these places, and actually got shot down because so many people you know, basically complained and you know, voted against it. But I think with the more time you spend in these places, you realize that the visitors aren't getting the true experience that they're actually even intending to go out and see. So I'd like to see something done in that regard. Obviously, I don't have the answers exactly as how to get that done, though.
Well, and we're proposing selling off mineral rights now in national parks and reducing the parks in area to open them for ranching. It's a serious problem, and there are vehement arguments on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
But the whole idea of national parks is such a good one, and trying to figure out how to make it accessible. For example, if you raise the fees, how are poor people going to be able to go there? There are no easy answers to this.
Yeah, it's tough. I think that the one good thing is, though, that there are enough people who care strongly about these places. I do think there are enough people who have their hearts in the right places. I'm pretty confident that, you know, whatever zigzag path it takes, that hopefully we'll find a better answer, because I think we need to. I think in many of the places, especially the most iconic parks that get the most visitation, those are the places that they're experiencing, you know, perhaps the most jeopardy right now.
Describe your writing process, Rob. Did you take notes each day as you went, or did you wait till the experience was over and sit back? Then did you move from there to an outline to take us through the writing of the book.
A circuitous path, let's say that. It was a bit all over the place. I did start out taking notes as I went. You know, I really wanted to try to capture all the small details, the things I might otherwise forget. I did that for about a day and a half before I realized it was actually impairing my my experience in the present moment. You know, I was too busy writing down, taking notes, or doing this, or snapping a photo that I wanted to remember for posterity's sake and to write about, that I wasn't actually experiencing it in the way that I wanted to or that would be meaningful to the book. So I quickly abandoned that and really just went about experiencing it wholeheartedly and just relying on the fact that I'd recall from memory. So when I came back, I really got to work right away on it. And I kind of took the piecemeal approach where I just wanted to, at least in the initial phase, I wanted to get a little writing momentum, let's say. I just wanted to put down a paragraph a day, let's say. It didn't even have to be a good paragraph. I just wanted to get in the habit of writing. I wanted to get a little momentum. And then eventually, you know, as I got more comfortable, you know, a 15-minute sessions, you know, pretty soon started rolling into half hour, 45 minute. And then when I was hot and heavy in the middle of it, I mean, God, I was writing 4 or 5 hours a night, staying up to 3, 4 in the morning. I mean, the night stock crew at Hy-Vee got to know me on a first name basis, because when I'd get done writing at about 4 a.m., I'd usually have to go and get a Diet Coke or something to wind down and, you know, shut my brain off for the night. So they got to know me pretty good. And honestly, it got kind of overwhelming at first, but that was just the actual what I call brain dumping process. So I was just putting everything on paper, what I ate at the gas station, what I did. And then eventually, though, the main gist of it, probably about 10 of the 15 months that it took, 10 of those months were spent editing it, winnowing it down. And what was 80,000 words manuscript, which, as you guys know, was about 500, 600 page book, ended up being finalized at 18,000 words. And I was very, very, very intentional about that. I wanted to have only my best stories, only my best experiences, no fluff, no filler. There's nothing I dislike more than a book that goes on 100 pages longer than it should have. So that was my intent on that.
So how did you go about getting it published?
Well, so I self-published. I never even actually considered the traditional publishing route. And the reason I did that was, for one, without an existing audience, so to speak, you know, or existing fan base or any prior writing work in any capacity whatsoever, I thought my odds of getting a major publisher were slim to none, and probably wasn't worth the year and a half it'd take me trying to wrangle a book agent and write all the propositions and all that. I knew what I wanted to write. I wanted to get it out there, which leads into the second thing. I also wanted complete creative control over it, too. In the off chance I did get a publisher, chances are it would have been one of the smaller, one of the more intermediate ones, which doesn't actually really do that much for you as far as getting you national exposure or anything like that. So I thought, if that's the best I could probably do, I might as well self-publish on my own. Retain complete creative control over the project, and then obviously maintain control of, you know, the majority of the royalty as well.
A lot of writers who could publish with major publishers, in fact, have gone to self-publishing for those very reasons.
Yeah, I think it's especially in today's day and age, it's so much more readily available with, you know, the self-publishing services are incredibly easy to use. Anybody can utilize them. It's very easy nowadays to be your own publicist, your own marketer, your own brand creator. And so I think for a lot of people, it is becoming a popular option. Even some of your, like you said, your most prolific writers are utilizing it to maintain more control over their product.
I assume it's available on Amazon. Is it available around here anywhere?
So it is available on Amazon, and you know, it has been, you know, very fortunately a bestseller in about 3 different travel categories from the day it came out. So that's been very fortunate. As far as buying a hardback, you know, here in town, I believe the Book Rack is the one place over in Davenport off of Elmore. Where you can still run in and grab
Augustana Bookstore doesn't have it?
I reached out to the Augustana Bookstore. Apparently, they didn't realize I was an alum and, you know,
Well, I would go back to them because people do go over there and buy books. You know, and they do have a whole section on local writers.
I might just have to walk across the street when we're done here. Especially bring you over. You're a distinguished professor over there. You might be just what I need.
No, extinguished.
Extinguished.
Okay, sure.
But it seems to be doing quite well.
Yeah, it is. I was very fortunate early on to really select a, you know, Amazon gives you the ability to select categories to kind of market your book through. I was able to find the right categories where I was able to target a very select audience. I was really looking for the specific things that, I was offering in my book, not just travel writing in general, but national parks, Yellowstone travel writing, or, you know, National Park Smoky Mountains. I was able to really specifically target, which was able to allow me to attain bestseller status. And when I was able to attain bestseller status, that's where I was able to really capitalize on media. The media suddenly became interested. You know, I had featured pieces in both the Dispatch, the QC Times. I was here in the studio with WVIK with Herb Trix. I did Paula Sands, the whole deal. I also did a 12-stop book tour around the Quad Cities area during the months of November and December. So all of that was able to really allow me to garner a lot of local momentum, generate a lot of positive reviews for the book, and then that's what created much of the national success, which it's remarkable. I still look, and every now and then I'll get book purchases from Europe or Canada. Wow. Or, you know, every state in the country. It's pretty incredible. And even, you know, over a year and a half into the process, actually the sales are better now when I'm not even advertising than they were when they first came out and I was, you know, advertising pretty significantly. So it's garnered a lot of positive word.
Well, it's that magic title, Rob.
I'll take it. I'll take it.
No, I mean, it is amazing what a difference that makes.
That's true. That is.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, even when I shop for my own books online or at the store, I mean, it's you can cast a book aside right away just if the title doesn't resonate with you. So I stumbled upon some gold there.
So what's next for a writing project?
Oh, gosh. So, God, that has been an ongoing...
That's the ugly question.
Developing, fluctuating thing. So while I had great success with the book, while I enjoyed it, I was thoroughly exhausted by the time it was all said and done. The writing process, especially for a first-time writer who didn't have a lot of experience, I made about every mistake you could possibly make. I ground my gears, like I said. You know, I was up in the wee hours of the morning, sometimes seeing the sun come up. And so I was pretty exhausted. And then, you know, with all, like I said, the book tour and, you know, different public speaking engagements, it kind of become all consuming. So I had kind of vowed that I was never going to write another book again, but I did enjoy the whole process. I really did enjoy traveling. I enjoyed accumulating stories and sharing them with people because I met all sorts of wonderful people at all these different events, and that did invigorate me. So I decided that I was going to create a travel documentary. So last summer I went on a trip on the Empire Builder. Are you guys familiar?
No, I've been on it 5 times.
Yeah. So I started off in Chicago, and for those who aren't familiar with it, the Empire Builder is a passenger rail train via Amtrak that goes from Chicago Union Station all the way out to either Seattle or Portland. And along the way, there's a lot of incredible places. So I stopped, for instance, in the North Dakota Badlands, Theodore Roosevelt National Park, did some things there. Glacier, of course, which I'd love to talk with you more about Glacier at some point because I really enjoyed it and didn't get to stay near as long enough as I'd like. Columbia River Gorge in Washington and Oregon. I ended up on the coast out in Oregon. So I documented that. I filmed it. I bought a bunch of expensive equipment, did all this stuff, video editing. I put together what I am actually very proud of was a really, really cool travel documentary that I recently finished a couple months ago. However, I did come to the stark realization that nowadays, if you're not on Netflix or HBO, it's very hard to get anybody to sit down and watch a 25-minute film. You know, most of the films that are watched online are little snippets, 30 seconds, 1 minute, 2 minutes most. And so it wasn't a medium where I felt that I was able to really get it out there, mass distributed and seen by the people that I wanted to. And besides, the thing that ultimately stuck with me as though is that I wasn't able to share so many of the great stories that happened off the camera. You know, when you're photographing something or filming, there's kind of a script to it, right? You know, I'm gonna do this, I'm gonna create this angle, I'm gonna show it in this way. But all the most interesting things happened off the camera. It was kind of just like my book. The most interesting things happened not because of where I went, but the unexpected things that happened along the way. So I kind of ditched the film project, and now I'm thinking about writing a book about my journey last summer, or more recently, actually, I actually started writing some fiction, which I've been working on for about the past month. And this is off the wall, but I'm looking to create kind of a national parks-esque Halloween story. So I was out in the Black Hills of South Dakota recently, and was up at Harney Peak, which is the one of the highest peaks out there. And there's an old watchtower out there, kind of spooky place, kind of mysterious. And it, for whatever reason, it inspired me. And I don't know, I got a Legend of Sleepy Hollow vibe going. And I'm looking to create a book for this Halloween, which I think I'm on track to get done.
Sounds to me like you caught the writing bug. And
a little bit. I swore it off.
Probably is not curable.
I swore it off, and then it came back and got me.
Yeah. I would suggest that you write Lost with Directions 2 and your locales be Chicago, L.A., New York, Newark. You can go byways in Chicago. You know, I went to the school in Chicago, and I would sometimes walk from the campus, the University of Chicago, to downtown, 8 miles to downtown, and you go through the most incredible places that you never would know about.
Well, especially me, is, you know, not really being a big city guy. You know, I've always been one of those, you know, I grew up in Kelowna, Illinois, okay. So a small town. Yeah, I'm still a little intimidated by the big city sometimes. That would perhaps be even more of an adventure, is take on the big cities of America. That might be a really fascinating idea.
And, of course, there's still other national parks you haven't lost in.
A million of them, yeah.
And I would think there are some national parks and monuments that we don't know anything about. Everyone knows about Yellowstone.
Yep. We've
heard of the Tetons and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm amazed when I look at a catalog of national parks. There are places I've never heard of.
Oh, it's remarkable.
Monuments I've never heard of. So it might be interesting to dig into those little-known places.
Well, and that's part of what I tried doing recently on my trip to South Dakota. I had originally thought of maybe doing some writing on that, and I tried to follow some landmarks on the Oregon Trail, for instance, through Nebraska. That was kind of interesting. But yeah, to your point, Don, I sometimes just Google search least visited national parks. And that's a pretty cool way to find out the places that nobody goes to. So, for instance, Isle Royal up in the middle of Lake Superior
right. –
in Michigan, you know, that's an incredible spot that very few people go, because you can only fly in or take a, you know, perhaps 2-hour ferry ride. And so I'm looking to get up there perhaps soon as well.
Well, it gives you an excuse, you know, to get out of town.
That's how I always justify it to my wife. I'm going to do some research for work.
So who did you go with on these trips?
Yeah, so part of it was spent solo. Part of it was with some friends. So my first leg to the Smoky Mountains, my friend Corey, another Augustana alum who I've known actually since we were youngsters, came along with me. I did the Yellowstone segment on my own. And then I met up with some other childhood friends, kind of used it as an excuse to get together. It was almost like a pre-bachelor party, because it was only a couple months before I was getting married. So it was my excuse to get my friends together and do some fun things with them.
Well, I must say, you have turned out a very successful book, and it sounds as if you've had fun along the way.
I have. I'd say the most enjoyable parts have been meeting, you know, folks like you or folks in the public that come out to greet me and say hello.
Well, we've been talking with Rob Irwin, whose popular book on national parks is called Lost with Directions. It's available on Amazon, and we know it's available at the book rack, and shop around, you should be able to find a copy. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you very much, guys. Absolute pleasure.
I really appreciate the trip, and I'm going to have to go to one of these places one of these times. That'll do it for today's session. We're clean out of time. Thanks to Rob Irwin, and we'll be back next week. I'm Don Wooten with Roll Tweet. Join us for the next session of Scribble.